Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
The Best in the World podcast with Richard Parr.
It's one of the most iconic images in the history of the Olympic Games. Derek Redmond hobbling to the finish line with his father after tearing his hamstring in the 400 metres semi-final at the 1992 Barcelona Olympics. Derek was determined to cross that line, and he talks to me on this week's Best in the World with Richard Parr. I think you'll find it incredibly insightful into what he says was going through his mind when he tore his hamstring at that event. It's pretty amazing. It's an amazing story of grit and determination, and a really interesting part of this conversation with Derek Redmond. And one of the great things about this podcast is that I do speak to gold medalists and champions, and Derek is a champion. He was part of the 4x400 metres relay team, the great British team that won gold at the 1991 World Championships. But there's also a lot to be learned from failures and how people grow from them. But I wouldn't even say that 1992 was a failure for Derek. It was a moment of heartbreak for him. But he admits in this podcast that he didn't want to talk about it for many, many years because he didn't want to think about it. It was a heart-wrenching moment for him. But over time, he's realised what we all get out of it, and he makes it clear in this podcast. But I think it is clear that we're inspired by him, the fact that he never wanted to give up, that he wanted to cross that line. And I think that's a lesson that we can all use in our everyday life. So it's pretty cool to speak to Derek about that. And of course, he does talk about that victory in Tokyo in 1991. That team with Chris Akabusi, John Regis, Roger Black, all winning gold, defeating the pretty much heavy favourites in America to win that gold medal. And he talks about how they changed the lineup just before the race and it proved to make the difference, and that Derek ran one of his fastest 400 metre laps ever. So it's a brilliant conversation with Derek. After athletics, he became a professional basketballer. He competed at a high level in rugby sevens, in motorcycling, in kickboxing. And he talks about the transferable skills from athletics to all of these various different sports. It's really good when it comes to the idea of mindset, how you can win an event before you even step on the track or step into the field of play. It's a brilliant conversation with Derek Redmond, and it's coming up in just a moment on this episode of The Best in the World with Richard Parr. And I mentioned things like grit and determination, and these are a lot of the topics that we cover on The Best in the World with Richard Parr, and we talk about them further in our new Facebook group. It's called Best in the World. Search it on Facebook. I'll put a link to it on the show notes page, and it's where me and you and everyone else part of this community can have a conversation about all of the things related to sports and high performance. So go and check it out on Facebook, The Best in the World group. All right, let's get started. Let's speak to Derek Redmond, the 4x400 metres relay gold medalist from the 1991 World Championships. He is the best in the world.
The Best in the World podcast with Richard Parr.
Derek,
Derek Redmond, world champion from the 1991 championships, where you won the 4x400 meters relay. Welcome to the best in the world with Richard Parr. You had an incredible career, but first let's try and catch up with what are you up to at the moment, Derek?
For the last 20 odd years, I've been a motivational speaker. So I spend a lot of my time traveling, well, pretty much the world, speaking at conferences and at events for different companies and organizations. I'm also a director of a company called Thomas International that specializes in psychometric assessments, and I'm the group performance director. So keeping myself very busy at the moment.
Oh, that's interesting. A psychometric test, like, what does that involve?
So psychometric assessments, more than tests, because tests almost means like, you know, there's a right or a wrong. Well, sort of the assessments that we do, it really, depending on the actual assessment, it looks at things like your work-based behaviours, your personality, for want of a better term. So a lot of people might be familiar with them when it comes to applying for a job, for argument's sake, and part of that process might be that organisation might ask you to take a quote-unquote personality test to see if you're the right person for the right role.
Oh.
So International are a company that supports these particular assessments, and there are different assessments depending on what you're looking for in a certain individual, what you're trying to find out, whether it's their emotional intelligence, work-based behavior, whether it's their speed of learning, whether it's their potential within a job. So there's lots of different sort of assessments that we provide.
Is that something which could be useful for, say, a sports team?
It is in sports now. So over the last, I mean, we have a division, Thomas Sport. We have a section of our, we have a company actually within, there's three companies really. Thomas International, which looks after the business side, then there's Thomas Education and Thomas Sport. So yes, we are pretty prolific in the world of sport. And yes, obviously the obvious one is in team sports. And also really relationships between coach and athlete, for want of a better term. Yes, it is used in sport in this day and age.
Mm. So have you done an assessment with the four runners from the 4x400 meters winning team from 1991? Should you have been together?
Yes, I have.
Really?
Yes, I have, and yes, I should have done. Albeit a few years late, but it is quite interesting. So I did an assessment, one of the assessments that looks at your work-based behaviours, your motivators, your demotivators, the way you like to, you know, prefer to communicate. And that sort of thing, and yes, it to be honest with you, it didn't throw up any surprises. Pretty much some of the traits within the behaviours of all four of us, I guess, are still here now that we had 26 years ago. And you know, people always ask, was it an act? You know, was it luck that you guys decided to change the order? And we all say, we've always said, no, it wasn't down to luck. It was the fact that we, you know, communicated with each other. We had a conversation and we came up with what we thought was the best order. And without going through the whole story now, when you look at that story and you look at the behaviours that the assessment kind of revealed, there was no surprise that conversation took place in the way that it did, and we came to agreement in the way that we did because of our behaviours. So, so yes, I have assessed the guys, and none of us need up or anything like that, and we were certainly a good fit, and said on that night that what we did was the right thing.
It was indeed, and we will go into that in a little bit more detail, but we've caught up with a little bit of what you're up to at the moment, and we'll talk a little bit about your post-race career as well, but let's get to the start now, Derek. How did you first get interested in running in the 400 meters in the first place?
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Well, there's two questions, really, because the question is, how did I get involved in running? Because I didn't start, obviously, as a 400-meter runner. So to answer that part, very simple, 7 years of age, running in my school sports day. A young guy from the local athletics club came down to present the prizes, gave a little bit of a speech, explained where the club was, what days they met, at what times. My parents were there, and I simply asked, can I join, because I fancy giving it a go. They said yes, and I went down to, as it was, Milton Keynes Athletics Club. And I started at the age of 7, doing a bit of everything, high jump, long jump, triple jump, shot put, javelin, bit of sprinting, bit of middle distance, and all of the above, bar the sprinting, I wasn't particularly successful at, so it didn't take long to sort of drop all those particular events. And I stuck to sprinting, 100s and 200s. And I ran 100s and 200s until I was about 15. In between the times, I'd moved from Milton Keynes to Northampton. So I was, one particular day, I was running for my club in Northampton, and I ran the 100, finished third, ran the 200 and finished third. And the young guy who was supposed to run the 400 metres didn't show up. So our team manager was desperate for someone to run the 400 because it was a team competition. And even if you came last in your event, you got a point for your team. So it was 8 points for first, all the way down to 1 point for eighth. So, and at the end of the day, it was a team with the most points that won the competition. So just to put someone in, it was a point, because all the points obviously added up and totaled up at the end. And my dad just said to me, why don't we give it a go? Or in fact, his quote was, why don't you have a go at running the 400? What have you got to lose besides another race? We kind of had a bit of a laugh and a joke about it. And I had no idea how to run the 400, but I sort of gave it a go and ended up winning the race and breaking the county record in the first 400 I ever ran. And, you know, for my age group, that was. And I quite liked that feeling of winning. And I thought, oh, next week I'll run another one, which I did. And then for the next, it was the second half of the season, so there wasn't that much time of the season left, maybe a month, 5 weeks or something like that. And I ran 400s for the rest of the season, won them all, each time got quicker and quicker, and decided, that's it, I'm going to be a 400 metre runner. And that winter, started training for 400s, and then the following year, ended up finishing second in the English schools, getting my first international, and as they say, the rest is history.
Amazing. So during that time, Derek, how much training were you putting in, and how would that work around your school day?
To be honest, at that time, when I was at school, you know, we trained Tuesdays, Wednesdays and Thursdays, sort of after school, 6-7 o'clock. And then, you know, we'd train over the weekends as well, Saturday mornings and or Sunday morning. So it was kind of a 5-day situation at that point, a 5-day routine, if you like, and it was for a couple of hours, 2.5 hours a day. As things went on, then the training picked up, and I remember, you know, Mondays we started to do some, you know, some sort of circuit stuff, and then Tuesdays on the track, Wednesdays was on the track, Thursdays was on the track, Fridays was always a bit of a rest day, and then Saturdays would be, you know, going for a run, and Sundays again would be another track session. So then it kind of stepped up to sort of 6 days a week, and that's when, you know, when it really started to become more of my life. And I would say that was possibly, you know, once I'd left school, sort of teen onwards, when it really started to become almost a full-time job, if you like.
Was it always enjoyable, or did it start to become more of a job?
No, never. It never became a job. It was always enjoyable. Don't get me wrong. Some of the sessions were awful. and as I got, you know, better and in, you know, sort of higher ranked in the world, and it did become my profession, if you like. So when I did become a professional athlete, I still enjoyed it. The problem was some of the sessions, as I say, weren't good. And, you know, there were certain parts. The winter months are always the worst. And they were the where we did all the donkey work. So none of the glamorous stuff, none of the fast stuff, no racing. It was just, as I refer to it, pure donkey work. And some of those sessions, you know, you would either throw up or pass out at. And you knew the sessions that was going to happen. And I can't say you looked forward to it. I can't say I looked forward during it. And I can't say I enjoyed the recovery after. So there were certain sessions that were tough. But that's, you know, that's part of it. And that's not just in my event. That's in any event, and I guess in any sport.
It's that kind of weird sensation, isn't it, that when you're being sick, it's like, oh, well, I hate being sick, but actually this means it was a really good session and I've worked really hard.
Well, yeah. Well, that was the thing. I mean, you know, I know things have changed now and we know a lot more about the body and there's a lot more sports science involved. But back then, if you didn't throw up or, you know, a couple of times a week and pass out at least once a week, you hadn't put a hard week's graft in. I'm glad to say things have changed and it's quite like that anymore. But that was the sort of attitude, almost, you know, more better. And, you know, quality over quantity, where obviously the whole training programs has changed a bit nowadays, and it's not quite as I won't say barbaric, but it's not kind as raw as it was back then.
Is there anything that you may have learned in the last 20 years or so, just from the outside in, learning about the changes of the body and the sports science, that you wish you had during your day? Is there anything in particular that you've seen and you've gone, oh, if only we had that when I was training?
Well, I mean, facilities to start, equipment is always great. But it's actually my coach who still coaches this, you know, these days, and I'm not completely up on all the sort of training regimes and programs and all sorts what's going on these days. However, my coach does every now and say to me, if he knew then what he knows now, you know, my career would have been, you know, completely different for the better. And the kind and the style of training that they do now, he said, me and my body would have really, you know, reacted well to that sort of stuff. You know, so he does say that, God, if he'd known all the stuff that he knows now, you know, things would have been different, possibly less injuries and that sort of stuff. So yeah, of course, you know, as time goes on, techniques improve, we find out more information, we learn a lot more, and, you know, there are things. But, you know, I'm sure in 20 years' time, you could say the same to the athletes of today. And in 40 years' time, you can say something to those athletes 20 years down the line, and it'll always continue to improve, because that's the nature of the booster.
Was that coach Tony Hadley?
Yes, Tony Hadley, and not the lead singer of Spandau Ballet, as I always say.
Even if you did win gold.
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
So what was your relationship like with Tony, and how did it first begin?
My relationship with Tony is still very, very good. We had a very close relationship. We don't speak, obviously, as often as we used to, because I don't see Tony every day, where at one point I was pretty much sitting every day or talking to him every day. But we still have a great relationship. We still share conversations. Tony's still coaching, as I say, and he will pick the phone up to me and ask my advice on athletes that he's now coaching. He'll ask for my advice. He'll sometimes ask me to talk to his athletes. So the big name that he's coaching at the moment, one of, is a guy called Matthew Hudson-Smith, who is, you know, the sort of the top 400 meter runner in the country, arguably, at the moment. So, you know, I spend a bit of time with Tony and, you know, chatting with him and keeping an eye on what he's sort of getting up to. So we still have a very good relationship. I've known Tony a number of years. In fact, I think one of the first years I met Tony would have been about 1983. So I'd only been running 400s a couple of years. And he used to coach an athlete by the name of Phil Brown, who was arguably one of the world's best relay runners. He was synonymous for the last leg. But a great 400 meter run in an individual anyway. And he was the guy I wanted to train with. And I remember the first time I asked to be coached by Tony, Tony actually said, no, I don't think you're ready. You need a couple more years with your current coach. There's no need for you to go from where you are and what you're doing to come and join me, because things are going quite well. And then a couple of years after, I went back because I had improved and I did want to take the next stage. One, a club in a better league, for want of a better term. And secondly, I still wanted to train with Phil. And I went back to see Tony, and Tony, we had a couple of training sessions, and Tony wanted to see, one, how I kind of operated mentally, how I fitted in with the rest of his group. And I don't know, I went and did maybe 2, 3, 4 sessions with him over a couple of weeks or whatever. And then he made a decision, yes, you know, I think you would make it a good addition to his training group. And I joined Tony in 1985. And that was that. You know, I still argue he still is my coach, even though he doesn't physically train me. But I've never fired him, sacked him, or said, right, that's it, you're officially no longer my coach. You know, even when you retire, he's still your coach, you know, and he always will be.
Yeah, I think it'd be a bit harsh if you sacked him now.
We haven't done much for him in the last 10, 15 years, man. I'm not impressed with his work, I'm really not.
Now, you mentioned that with the changes in the last few years, that Tony said to you that you'd have had less injuries, and you really did have a horrid time throughout your career with injuries. Just how mentally was that tiring?
It's very tiring. I think the mental side comes into it once you've been injured and you're trying to recover to get back to where you were. There's a number of things that go on in your head. One is the frustration of being injured yet again. And that in itself brings in issues of trying to stay focused and motivated and positive that you can get back to where you were. So you know, you're fighting demons and battles in that respect. And it is quite tough. You know, having that self-belief and confidence that, okay, I'm injured, I can get back to where I was. The realization that, and this is a horrible sort of realization, that the athletics world won't stop and wait for you. It carries on as if you don't exist. And ideally what you want is you want a magic remote control that you can press the pause button and the whole of the athletics world pauses until you get back to where you were, and then you can press play again and carry on. And in reality, that doesn't happen. The world just goes on. Everybody continues running, racing, and you're not even mentioned. And that's kind of hard to deal with, because it kind of puts into perspective that you're just, another statistic and another name. And if you're there, you're there. If you're not, the show will go on. And it's selfish, but it's something that all athletes kind of go through, because you end up in quite a lonely place, regardless to the amount of people that you've got around you, supporting you, you know, helping you. It is quite a lonely place to be, sitting and watching people run races, win races in times that you know you can do. Mm. And I've sat and watched people win major championships in times where I think, my God, you know, I've run quicker than that already this season. And they're winning, you know, major championships with these times. It's a hard, to use a phrase that my dad used to say, it's a hard pill to swallow. So that's quite tough. Coping with the injury, having the belief and the confidence that you can go flat out on the injury once you have gone through that recovery, because you always have that belief or that slight doubt. What if it breaks down again? And if, like me, you had multiple injuries of the same particular muscle, same area, then that becomes harder and harder as the time goes on. And, you know, I went through a stage where I thought I was just getting myself in shape to get injured. And I used to think I was the injured person in the world at one point. Mm. And that's kind of how I used to view it. But you really do have to kind of fight those negative thoughts and think, this is the one, this is the time, this is the time we're going to get it right. We've done this slightly different. We're going to take longer to, you know, recover. We're going to do this. We're going to get it right. And then you break down again. I think the one thing that always kept me going was the belief that I had in myself of what I felt that I could run if only I could stay injury free. So for me, belief in my ability, that if I could stay healthy, I know I could run pretty quick. And unfortunately, I don't believe, and I suppose you could argue every athlete says this, but I certainly don't believe I ever ran as fast as I could have done. And I know it because my personal best was done in a race where I actually slowed down, just doing enough at the World Champs in 1987 to qualify. And if I'd known then what I know now, I wouldn't have slowed down. I would have kept on going, just because if that was the last chance I had of sort of running a quick time, then I would have given it everything rather than just do enough to win the race and qualify for the final. So for me, that was the biggest thing that I kind of grabbed onto, was that self-belief, knowing that I can run a lot quicker than I've already run. And my biggest problem wasn't, gosh, can I run any quicker? It was, gosh, can I run quick without breaking down?
Yeah, I can understand that. And of course, you had injury troubles going into these World Championships in 1991, and you nearly didn't race, did you?
Correct. Well, I mean, I was always going to do the individual, and I was typical sort of Redmond season. I was, for want of a better term, chasing my tail. So in other words, I managed to sort of scramble into the British team for the individual 400. Albeit not in the manner that I would have liked to have done. So I was sort of, if you like, on the back foot, but I managed to scramble in to the team. And it was a case, because I had a few injuries that year, I hadn't raced as many times as I wanted. So I was trying to play catch up. And rather than using the qualifying rounds just to qualify, I was using them, one, to qualify, but two, to get another race under my belt, which is not a great way to be running in a major championship. You know, you when you go to a major championship, you want all the races that you need, and you've done those races. You've posted a quick time. You're in great shape. You should be able just to qualify, just do what's needed to qualify, and you know, build yourself up for the final. Well, I was having to not only qualify but use those races as races. So in other words, I had to run them as normal races, as if it wasn't the heat of a world championship, as if it was just a race, because I didn't have the luxury of having posted a quick time where I could, I don't know, go into a race 75% off speed and know I'm still going to qualify. I was having to give it everything, hoping that what I've got in me is enough to get me through the first round. Plus then you've got to make it look like you're not giving it everything, because if your competitors go, hey, he's flat out here. His pedal is down to the metal. You know, he hasn't got any more left, because mentally that gives them an edge. So you're running flat out, but you're trying to make it look like you're just going easy. And it's not a great way to be, you know, in a major championship. And I scrambled through the heats, the second round, and I got as far as the semi-final. And no matter how I ran a 400, I couldn't seem to run any quicker than about 45.5, 45.6, which at world level is not particularly quick. And it was very frustrating. And I remember after getting knocked out, and it was the first major championships that I'd ever been to and not made a final. Every major championship that I'd competed in, I'd always at least make the final. And I, you know, as you can imagine, I was pretty distraught. And I remember speaking to my coach and the coach of the relay team, and I said, look, you've got five guys who are in good shape, who are running well. I don't think I'm in shape to run in the relay, and I don't want to jeopardize our chance of winning a medal, because we knew we could win at least the silver. And there was a possibility that if all went well, we could, you know, give the Americans a bit of a run for their money when it comes to winning the gold. And I actually wanted to drop out. And I can remember being on the warm-up track with my coach and with the coach of the relay team, a guy I remember, Frank Dick. And then both saying to me, well, look, just run the heat, because there was still about seven or eight days to go before the heat of the 4x4. So I had 7 or 8 days of training that I could put in, plus run the heat. So we agreed that I would train for the next 6, 7, 8 days, however many days were left, and then run the heat. And then after the heats, they would make a decision on whether, you know, I should run in the final or not. Because both Frank and Tony agreed, I am getting quicker each race, which I was, but I just didn't think there was enough time to get quick enough in such a short space of time. So I remember Tony sort of devising a bit of a very short training program where literally every other day I ran the equivalent of a race. It may not have been over 400, but I'd run a 300 time trial or a 200 meter time trial, or, you know, so I kind of raced in training. So rather than doing reps, you know, sort of doing, you know, three or four or five different reps in a session, we would warm up as if it was a race and do a one-off sprint, you know, work on some techniques and bits and pieces. And as that sort of week of training went on, the times did begin to come down and start to tumble. And it looked, you know, like, okay, definitely I'll run the heats. So I sort of, the times convinced me to run the heat. And I ran the heats and ran a quick time. I actually, you know, ran all of a sudden, dropped a second off almost all of a sudden. I'm running 44.7 rather than 45.7. And I don't think I particularly ran as quick as I could have done. Again, did enough to qualify. And then when it came to picking the order and the four guys for the final, you know, Frank selected myself to run the first leg. And actually, I felt quite comfortable with that because I think I'd proven to myself that I was in shape to do myself justice, and more important, to do the rest of the team justice. And I didn't feel I was going to let them down. So I almost didn't run, but thanks to the foresight of not only my coach but also Frank, who, you know, said, look, don't give up yet, you've got a week to try and get things right, let's have a look after the heat. So it was a gamble that paid off.
And eventually you did your leg and you did it as low as 44.1, I believe.
Yeah, first time.
And you mentioned back in 1987 when you got your personal best, which you actually kind of slowed down in. During your lap in this 4x400 meters, there's been a few conversations I've had on this podcast where some athletes have been speaking about getting in the zone. Were you in the zone in that lap?
Every race I compete, I always get in, if you want to use that phrase, get in the zone. My Tony and I used to call it getting in the groove, because we used to use the word groove for the simple reason, to be a champion, you need two things. You've got to be physically fit, which is kind of obvious, but you also need to be mentally fit. You can get in the zone and get yourself mentally fit, but being in the zone doesn't mean physically you're fit. So we used to use the phrase, you know, you're in the groove, which was mentally and physically fit. And I think there was a difference. So yes, every race that I ran, every good race that I ran, every race in a major championship, I certainly used to get myself in the groove, as I refer to. Certainly in the zone, and, you know, if I wasn't injured, then yes, in the groove. So at those world championships, I certainly wasn't in the groove for the individual 400, but it did come around for the relay. But that happens before you step on the track, you know, way before you step on the track. If you're not in the zone or in the groove by the time you step on the track, you ain't going to get in it. It's too late. You know, all that preparation, the mental preparation, happens a couple of hours, you know, before, you know, the race, because you have so much that you've got to go through. Things like, you know, just the reporting process. And I'm not sure if you're aware of what used to happen in a competition, whether it's an individual or a relay, track, field, doesn't matter what it is. An hour before your race, you have to be fully warmed up and ready to compete or your event. And you report for your race. That basis, that's going into a room the size of an average classroom, if there is such. And it's just you and the other seven competitors in this room. And you're basically left there for 45 minutes or so to sit around and wait. You're all collected in there. An official will come in and check your numbers and check you've got everything, give you your lane draws and confirm all that, and give you your lane assignment numbers and or jump in order, throw in order, whatever, all that sort of stuff. And you're left in the room with the other seven guys that you're going to be battling out a gold medal for. And that's one of the places where races are won and lost, not out on the track or in the field. It's actually in that particular scenario. So you have to be physically ready way before you step on the track. And I've seen athletes crack in their in that scenario. In my event, I've beaten guys in that room before we get out on the track because the pressure is just overwhelming for some of them, and they can't take it. I won't mention the athlete's name, but we had a British athlete, funny enough, at I think at those same World Championships in 91, our reporting rooms were actually tents, if you like, marquees, in the infield of the warm-up track. So you do all your warming up and then you go into the infield and that's where you reported for your race. And there was three or four of these particular tents. Around the outside of the track was a load of port-a-loos. And we had a British athlete who reported for a race and he was, you know, this kid was a Commonwealth medalist. He was no slouch. And the pressure got that much for him. He ran out of the warm-up room and locked himself in one of the toilets and had to be talked out.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, so these can be quite pressure situations. So, you know, the mental side of it does happen way, way, way before you get onto the track. But going back to your original question, because I kind of slightly come off piste a little bit, if you like, is yes, for that particular relay race, all of us mentally were, you know, as strong as I guess we had ever been, certainly as a relay team. The fact that we had come together and decided to go against the original order of the team management, come up with our own order, stick to our guns, again, against the team managers, not all of them, but certainly one of them didn't particularly want us to run that order and was, you know, well, all right then, if you think this is going to be the way, go for it. But, you know, there was nothing going to stop us doing that. We were, you know, we were so mentally strong that this was the right order to do. It was part one of the reasons why I think we ended up winning the race.
So what was it like then, Derek, when you were able to step on the podium and say that you were a world champion and collect that medal?
What was it like? Blimey, that's a million-dollar question. I mean, obviously, it's fantastic. It's a great feeling. It's people, you know, I often say to people, I've heard the question asked and I've asked people the same question to see if they can guess what it is. And people always say, what is that feeling when you step on a podium? And actually, that feeling is one of relief. The first thing you feel is relief. When they put that medal around your neck, and the next time you watch a major championship, it doesn't have to be in athletics, it could be in any sport, when a medal or a trophy is handed, you know, it definitely works on podiums, when a medal is put around an athlete's neck, his or her neck, the first thing they do is they take a massive sigh of relief. And you see them blow their cheeks out, and it's relief, because what comes flooding back is all the doubts, the thoughts, the risks that you took, the gambles that you took, the training, the hard work, all that sort of stuff comes flooding back to you. So you have that elation, obviously, and you're really happy. The medal goes around your neck. It's one of relief. And then the next thing, people become quite emotional for the simple reason, everything comes flooding back. All the commitments, all the sacrifices, all the hard work you and other people have put in, the commitments that your partner, your parents, your coach, your physios, your doctors, your sports psychologists, your, you know, your exercise physios, whatever you've got in your, you know, members of your team, everything comes flying back to you. And that's when you start to get quite emotional, when people then start to lose it and the bottom lip starts to quiver. So you go through a number of emotions, but it's a great feeling. But it, you do go through these things, you know, and this is all in a 5-minute period, if that. You just go through this roller coaster of emotions. But I think the first thing is obviously, you know, the one of elation, but it is, for me, the first thing is that one of relief, because we gambled in the order, you know, we gambled in putting me in the race. I managed to stay healthy. Nothing broke down during the run. You know, we didn't drop the baton. You know, John ran fantastic. He wasn't even a 400 meter on it. You know, putting him on the third leg, bringing him in was a gamble, and that's got its a whole list of risks. Akabusi on the last leg. He never runs last leg. You know, was he going to do what he said he can do? All that sort of stuff. So it was all a bit of a gamble, but it all paid off.
High risk, high reward.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So It was all worth it, but it's, as I say, there's lots of risks that go with all that. And you, once it all sort of pays off, as I say, you have that massive, yes, it works, and you know, it is that first feeling of relief, as I said. Once you've gone through all that, and you've gone through the quivering lip and the emotional side, and you've got people like Akabusi on your team, all of a sudden, it's a bit of a party. You know, Chris is very vocal, he's very funny, we get on very well, all four of us there. We do get on well, and, you know, we spent many a year training with each other. In fact, we're still pretty close now. We pleasure in taking the mick out of the Americans, which, funny enough, they weren't too happy about. and it was, you know, a great experience to have been through.
The Best in the World podcast with Richard Parr.
We'll come back to Derek in just a moment, but I want to say about Patreon. Now, one of the things that we talk about on this podcast from time to time is how these different sports stars are able to get sponsorship. And different stars have different perspectives on this. I remember Brian Clay being very good on it, and Sonia Looney was really good. Those episodes are all on iTunes and Stitcher and Acast. Go and look at the back catalogue there. But we also need money to be able to do this podcast for you. And so what we've done is set up a Patreon page. That means each month you can give us a small contribution, which will help keep the lights on here. Please go and check out patreon.com/bestintheworld. It's also a place where I give a little bit of news about the podcast ahead of time, so you know what's going on before the rest of the world. All right, so that's patreon.com/bestintheworld. All right, let's return to the conversation with the 4x400 meters gold medalist, Derek Redmond.
The Best in the World podcast with Richard Parr.
You mentioned a lot about emotion, and 1 year later, it is one of the most emotional scenes in Olympic history. The sight of you pulling up with your hamstring in the I think it was the semi-finals of the 400 metres, and you were determined to finish, and you ended up hobbling your way to the finish line with the assistance of your dad. Do you remember that very well, or is it a little bit of a blur?
No, I remember it very well. I spend most of my time talking about it. I remember it very, very well, unfortunately.
So just give us a bit more details about it for those who haven't seen it.
As you said, it was in the semi-finals. I'd won the first two rounds, so I was the fastest qualifier from the heat. I pretty much walked around in 45.03. I remember the coach saying to me, Tony saying to me, for the second round, he says, do exactly the same. So I virtually did in around 45.02. So I was only a hundredth out, which I remember him laughing and joking and saying, he said, I told you to do the same, not run a hundredth of a second quicker. So we had a bit of a laugh around it. And then both races were just very easy. I really, to use a quote, didn't really break a sweat. They were lovely, easy runs, well within, you know, with myself. There was no idea of any problems. There was no niggles. There was no tightness or whatever, general tightness that you will get generally from sort of, from running the major competition, but nothing major. And, it came to the semi-final, and it was just another race. This time I was going to finish the race. In other words, I was going to run a full race rather than messing around, just because I had 24 hours to recover before the final. I didn't want to take any risks. Win the semi-final, guarantee lane 3, 4, 5, or 6. And, you know, we're in a good position to have a go on the day of the final. Had a great start. Technically, everything was going well, going down the back straight. And then, I heard a funny pop. I thought it was a noise in the crowd, so I kind of said to myself, come on, Redmond, concentrate. And then a few yards later, I felt the pull of the hamstring and, you know, grabbed the back of my leg, And I'm, you know, down the back straight, you're going pretty quick. And to give you an idea, my split down the back straight of a 400 when I'm running well is around about 10.2, 10.3 seconds. Granted, it is a rolling start, that 100, but it gives you an idea that we're running pretty, you know, pretty quick down the back straight. So to pull a hamstring at that speed isn't the most pleasant of feelings. And I grabbed the back of my leg and wanted to stop as soon as I could. And I remember sort of hitting the track, and you know, a few choice words were coming out of my mouth. And you know, along the lines of "out through there," I think I pulled my hamstring in the Olympic semi-final. I wonder why that's happened to me. Type scenarios. And then I don't know. After a while, I remembered where I was and what I was doing. It was the Olympic semi-final. I remember thinking to myself that I wanted to see where all the athletes were, and I sort of sat up and looked on the track, and they were, I don't know, about 120, 130 minutes to go. And I just thought, if I get up now and start running, I'll catch them. And again, going back to being mentally in shape, I still believe that I could catch them. So it kind of proves my belief that you need to be physically and mentally in shape to be a champion, because obviously physically in shape I wasn't, but mentally I was still in the same shape as I was prior to my hamstring being pulled, which was confident that I could finish in the top four. So the fact that I still, in my mind, felt I could finish in the top four, that's why I got up and started hobbling. Now, it might sound crazy to most people, and I guess in one part it is, but when you build yourself up physically and mentally to take on the race, it takes a reasonable amount to kind of knock you off that perch. And when you are in that shape, as I say, you know, it doesn't just disappear easily. So when I actually got up and started hobbling, it was with an aim to qualify. The reality only hit when I got to the 200 metre mark, so I'd hobbled 50 metres, and I had a look to see whether I was gaining on them, because again, in my head, I'm catching these guys. And it was only when I kind of looked across to see if I could see if I was catching these guys, then I realised it all finished. Mm. And that was the point when I realised it was all over. And then that was at the point when I decided I'm going to finish this race if it's the last race that I ever run. And the last thing I expected of 100 metres ago was my old man to join me on the track.
Well, it's an amazing story of determination, Derek. I watched it again last night, and I'll be honest, I was nearly in tears myself just watching it, what you were able to do. It was incredible. I've read in an interview since then that you said you were angry for 2 years. I've got a bit of a pronged question here. What was daily life like during that time, and how did you eventually stop being angry?
It wasn't so much, I suppose it was angry. I think it took me 2 years to get over it. I didn't particularly want to talk about it. I didn't particularly want to watch it. I didn't particularly want to have anything to do with it. And it took 2 years to kind of deal with it. There you go. Of course, I was angry. I was angry because I was in the best shape of my life. It was my second Olympics. I'd been injured at my first Olympics when I had an outside chance of a medal. I had a really good chance of a medal, obviously, at the Olympics. Yeah, of course I was angry, I was frustrated, but it wasn't something that I particularly wanted to talk about. And the problem that I had is everybody wanted to talk about it. Here we are 25 years later, and surprise, surprise, everybody wants to talk about it. So when it was 2 years old, you know, it was no different. So it was very frustrating, very annoying. But the one thing, the worst day of my life, is something that everybody wanted to keep bringing up and talking about. And I didn't, in those early days, see what people saw in it or understood what other people got out of watching it and sort of gained any kind of, I don't know, motivation or comfort for themselves out of what turned out for me to be, you know, a really bad day, and I didn't win a medal that I felt I could have and should have won. So, yeah, it took a couple of years for me to kind of realize that people looked at it in a completely different way to the way that I was looking at it and viewing it, you know, and it's only when I began to see the way other people viewed that particular incident, then you kind of go, oh, okay, I get what people see, and the amount of emails and letters and messages that I used to receive from people saying, you know, how they've been through this in their life, they've been through X, they've been through Y, they've been through Z, whatever it is, and they saw that and it just helped them to stop giving up. And I thought, blimey, I had no idea that this was going to be received in the way, you know, the way that it was.
Yeah, no, and it was truly inspiring. And you retired, obviously, because of all of those injuries. And then, remarkably, you ended up playing basketball for England, doing rugby sevens, then doing superbike. All of these amazing different things. You've taken something which was a negative with these injuries into, again, more high performance success. Obviously, yeah. The rugby sevens, you would have your speed and I'm guessing in basketball as well. But what were some of the other transferable skills that you had from your time as a runner that you were able to use in basketball and rugby?
You know, whether it's basketball, whether it's rugby, whether it was racing motorbikes, whether it was kickboxing, that was something else I got into. It's simple. It's the mental approach. I wasn't the best basketball player in the world or in the country. I wasn't the best rugby player in the world or the country, the best kickboxer in the world or country, or the best motorcycle in the world or the country. But the one thing that I do very well is mentally get myself in shape to compete at whatever it is I'm doing. And I'm going to repeat myself here, you know, to be the best, you've got to be physically and mentally in shape. And the one thing that I used to do, and, you know, whether I was playing rugby or certainly when I was racing bikes, which was just at club level, and the guys, certainly my team, used to, you know, laugh and joke with me, is I would prepare for a race on a bike the same way mentally as I would for an Olympic final. And I would do the same thing the night before, getting my kit ready. It was just different kit. I would get up and do my own sort of warming up in my own special way. The exercises might have been slightly different, but mentally I'm going through exactly the same process because I'm getting ready to race at a certain time. And it's the only way that I sort of know how to do it. So any sport that I got involved, there's only one way I know how to prepare for it, and I have to prepare for it like an Olympian. And my wife will tell you that she says, God, whenever you get into a sport, you can't just do a sport for a hobby. You've got to get into it and do it fully. So, you know, I'm not very good at having hobbies, you know, and just, you know, taking up fishing and going sitting by the edge of a river once every 7 or 8 weeks, because that would, if I'm going to take up fishing, I'm going the whole way. You know, I'm you know, it would be all or nothing, and that's how it is with me and sport. So with all my relatively success in all the different sports, really, it wasn't because physically I was the most gifted and talented at it. Yes, there was, talent and ability along the lines at various levels in different sport. But for me, the biggest muscle that makes a difference is that one between your ears. I think that's where competition could be won and lost. I remember, for argument's sake, in 2013, I took up kickboxing. Never had done it before. And I started, May, June of 2013. And by October 2013, I'd become national champion for my category, for my ability. And I remember in one of the competitions because I ended up entering three different competitions in that competition, or disciplines within that competition. But the main one I wanted, which was the points, it was basically a knockout competition. So you win your first fight, you go to the next round, you win the second fight, you go to the next round, so on and so forth. And I think I may have had, three or four fights to get to the final. And I remember every fight that I had, again, I go through my own process, go and do my own thing, my own warming up, and give me up. I've got all the instructors there with me, and goodness knows what. And I walk onto the mat, and I get my last sort of few instructions from my... And I would walk onto the mat and stand on my side of the line, and I'd be waiting for my opponent, who's now getting his last minute of instructions from his coach, and he would walk onto the mat. So we're both standing behind our lines, which is maybe a metre or so apart, and the referee's kind of given us the final, you know, instructions, a bit like you get in a boxing match. Yeah. And I would always stare at my opponent in the eye. And all the way through the rounds, not one of the guys would stare me back in the eye. In my first fight, the second, the third, and the fourth. And the only guy that stood almost toe-to-toe with me and stared at me in the final was the guy in the final. And before all the other fights, I remember thinking, I've won this already, because this guy can't even look at me. If he hasn't got the confidence to look me in the eye before the fight, and I'm not talking snarling at each other,
yeah,
but, you know, just that, you know, sort of straight face, look him in the eye, come on, it's you against me, nobody else, let's get it on type thing. If they didn't have the ability and the confidence to do that, well, how are they going to have the confidence to kick and win? It's not going to happen. So mentally, I'd won those fights before I'd even started, because in my mind, these guys haven't even got the ability or the confidence to look at me. So they certainly ain't going to have the ability to out-punch, out-fight, and out-fox me. And none of them did. And then when it came to the final, the guy did stand sort of look me in the eyes. And I remember thinking, great, about time. I've got a fight on my hands. And I did. And I think I only won it by a point or 2 points. So for me, it's the physical side. It really is the mental, you know, the mental approach. But the other thing that was really interesting in that particular competition is, you know, word got round that Derek Redmond, the Olympic athlete, is, you know, he's competing in this. Oh, my goodness. And people constantly saying, blimey, how are we going to beat you? You're an Olympic champion. And it's like, well, one, I'm not an Olympic champion. And even if I was, it was at running, not kicking people. But again, mentally, that was enough to kind of have an edge and give you one up on other people. So it is amazing what the mind can do and the way that the mind actually works. And I use that in my favour and to my advantage rather than to a disadvantage.
So what sport's next for you, Derek?
Oh, the one that's killing me is golf at the moment. That's the one that's killing me. I'm actually thinking of playing a bit of rugby again because of work, I'm not as active as I was, and I do miss getting involved in a bit of sport. I also miss the sort of the male bonding bit and a bit of, you know, blokey time and whatnot. And as much as I love my golf, I've only sort of started golf in 2014, started back playing golf. I'm a bit of a fair weather golf at the moment, which I need to sort of take some time out and play a bit more, certainly for winter, and get some lessons. But I'm interested in playing a bit of rugby again, just for the social side of things and just to get out and do something. So I'm looking at playing some vets rugby or something like that.
Fantastic. Well, it's been really good to speak to you, Derek. It's been really good to learn from you and your amazing life and your amazing stories. Just before you go, Derek, why don't you just give us a reminder on where we can find you on social media or your website, or if we need you as a motivational speaker?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you know, from a speaking point of view, DerekRedmond.com is my website. And that will put me through to my management company that works. They look after me, so you'll be able to find me through there. I'm on Twitter at Derek_Red. And on Instagram, it's at Derek and Maria Redmond. So there's the three places that you can get hold of me.
Fantastic. Well, Derek, I've really appreciated speaking to you on this program. Thank you for being here, and thank you for being the best in the world.
Thank you very much.
The Best in the World podcast with Richard Parr.
Thanks so much to Derek for being on this week's Best in the World with Richard Parr. We've spoken to a few other track greats in the past on this podcast. Maybe go back and listen to my conversation with Veronica Campbell-Brown, the multi-time Olympic champion in sprinting. I've also spoken to the reigning 100 meters world champion, Tori Bowie. They're all on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Acast, and of course at sportacino.com. If there's any particular star you'd like me to interview, why don't you drop me a line? I'm on Twitter at Richard_Parr. I'd love for you to tell me who you'd like to hear from. But until then, I will be back next week with another Olympic champion, world champion, world record holder, or world number one
on The Best in the World. Goodbye.
The Best in the World podcast with Richard Parr.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.